Good morning. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Joy Cardine. It's coming up on 10 minutes past 8 o'clock on this Wednesday, December the 5th. We are happy to have with us this hour Pat Buchanan, former GOP presidential candidate, political commentator, best-selling author. His latest book is Day of Reckoning, How Hubris, Ideology, and Greed Are Tearing America Apart. He says that America is in crisis due to illegal immigration, but also over foreign policy mistakes and other economic problems. We will talk with Pat Buchanan about all of these issues this hour, and we will also get his take on some of the current political issues of the day. And we will welcome your questions for him, too, at 1-800-642-1234. 1-800-642-1234 in Madison, 263-1890, or send an email to talk@wpr.org. Please include your first name and your community with your email. And listeners are already lining up. Only one open line for you. We'll get to your calls as soon as we can and get to as many listeners as possible on the telephone. Let me welcome in our guest. Patrick J. Buchanan was a senior advisor to three American presidents. He ran for the Republican nomination in 1992 and 1996, and he was the Reform Party's presidential candidate in 2000. Mr. Buchanan is a syndicated columnist, a founding member of the McLaughlin Group and the Capital Gang and Crossfire, and he is the author of several books, including his latest, Day of Reckoning, How Hubris, Ideology, and Greed Are Tearing America Apart. Good morning.
Morning, Joy.
Thank you so much for joining us.
Well, thank you for giving me the time.
Well, certainly we will talk about the issues that you present in your book, but I wanted to start off, first of all, just read your resume there and all the times you've run for president. I saw a poll the other day that said if you ran for president, you would collect like 12% of the vote. Are you thinking of running for president?
I think it might be a little late for that, Joy. but what it did suggest, the poll, was that if you had a conservative pro-life candidate in a three-way race with Rudy Giuliani and Hillary Clinton, that conservative candidate, I got 12%, they put my name in there, would sink the Republican candidate, and that's probably a good argument if you're a conservative for not running with, in a third-party campaign.
Because that would hurt the Republican side.
Yeah, it would hurt people with whom you agree in part to assist people with whom you agree almost not at all.
Yeah, so that means you don't think, as some have been talking about, that Ron Paul should run as an independent.
Well, a lot of folks feel he should run as an independent. I ran as an independent back in 2000, and I found out the hurdles that you confront. But the bottom line is, Joy, as you get closer to the election, I told Ralph Nader, it's like we were in the Gator Bowl, and Gore and Bush were in the Super Bowl, and all the attention was moving toward them. And it was a close race, and it was going to be decisive as to who was president. And many folks who liked me, must have been 100, told me, I love you, Pat, but we've got to get the Clintons out of the White House and the Gores out of the White House. And so all the attention gravitates to the top candidates. Unless you've got the kind of money that Ross Perot or Mr. Bloomberg have, you really can't be competitive. And the two parties manage the debates. And so they keep you out of the debates, which keeps you down in single digits, if even there. So there's an awful lot going against it. Now, Ron Paul ran as a libertarian candidate. I believe it was 88 or 78, one of those 2 years. But he's indicated he will not do that, because if he did, I think it would really hurt the Republicans very badly, and he's a Republican congressman.
Yeah, do you like one of the Republicans running more than the others?
Well, I like a lot of them. My sister's managing, I believe, the Tancredo campaign. Duncan Hunter and I have been friends for a long time, and he's very good on trade, and he's very good on immigration. And other candidates have, attractive positions. Huckabee's very good on social issues and right to life. But there's no ideal candidate, and I feel that I really ought not to endorse, that you ought to let these folks sort it out themselves.
Yeah. While you aren't endorsing, you like especially the immigration stands of Tancredo and Duncan?
Yeah, the immigration stand. Well, Tancredo has been a real hero here, and Duncan Hunter has been a very early leader in this cause, and they, frankly, what they have done is affected the movement of all the top candidates, McCain even, Rudy Giuliani, and Mitt Romney, who were very, what we might call weak on border security and immigration control, to much stronger positions. Fred Thompson has always had a pretty good position on immigration, as far as I know, and I think he's got some strong ideas on that, too. So they've really done their job in terms of moving the center of gravity of the Republican candidates toward a much tougher, stronger policy on immigration. And frankly, Joy, that is the one issue that can sink Hillary Clinton if she's nominated. You noticed how she was forced to abandon her position favoring driver's licenses for illegal aliens, as was Governor Spitzer of New York, when 70% of New Yorkers professed themselves outraged at giving driver's licenses to illegal aliens. The Democratic position, which is pretty much the Bush position, in favor of a path to citizenship, which is another word for amnesty, I think is the one issue on which the Democrats could lose the presidential election, the domestic issue.
Yeah, let me. I'm going to go to the phones a little earlier than I usually do because we have so many listeners lined up. John in Delafield, hi, you're on the air.
Yes, good morning. I published a column back in, 3-4 years ago. It's called Remember That Speech Pat Buchanan Made in 1992 in the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. I sent a copy to him, and Pat was nice enough to acknowledge it with a note, which meant a great deal to me. I don't know that he remembers. But I wish he was jumping into the race. I'm curious, if you took the abortion issue off the table in national politics, who he would support amongst the current crop of Republican candidates, if you took that off the table.
Yeah.
Well, I still, on the other issues, foreign policy, I'm really... I'm very closer to Ron Paul on foreign policy than I am to almost any of the other candidates. Are you talking about supporting a candidate who's among the front runners and probable winners? I really would prefer not to get into saying who I would prefer because there are some I would prefer, and that would be tantamount to an endorsement. But you know, if you get into the general election, let me say this. My central concerns outside of right to life and the social cultural issues, which I think are very important for the Republican Party to stand on as a representative of traditional America, outside of that, I would like to see a candidate who understands what trade is doing to the American worker, who understands that the masses of immigration, when you have 38 million immigrants in the country and a third of them illegal, when the melting pot is broken, risk the country. And I would like someone aware of the fact that we are overextended as an empire and that we're getting ourselves involved in wars after wars after wars, which are the death of republics. And so a candidate along those lines is one that I would like to see. And some of the front runners do, I think, fail the foreign policy test.
Yeah. Thanks, John. Rick in Medford. Hi, you're on the air.
Oh, let me just say what an honor it is to speak to Pat Buchanan.
We got a fuzzy phone line, Rick. Can you be real brief?
Okay. Well, I wanted to talk about political culture. In Milwaukee, I made several comments on this radio station concerning the police corruption in the city, and because of that, one of the staffers at your station...
Rick, I'm sorry you're wasting your time talking about something that might have happened a long time ago regarding the station. Let's not waste time during this program with that. Lou and Cudahy, hi, you're on the air.
Hi. Many thanks to Pat Buchanan for his book, State of Emergency. I'm going to get that and read it. All the candidates have seemingly have walked away from the rule of law and order in this country. You know, this illegal alien thing, they're touching on it. Huckabee, who was my guy, is walking away from it completely, and he wants to... Give tuition to the children of illegal aliens in his state, and that amounts to social liberalism. I don't want that. I want the rule of law enforced. And I think the people in this country really are in a state of unease, let's call it that, or dis-ease, whatever you want to call it, where we don't have the rule of law being enforced, and it's really, really sad on the part of all of these candidates.
Mm-hmm.
Right? I think you're exactly right. The Congress of the United States has passed laws that the President of the United States refuses to enforce. For his first 5 years, he virtually abandoned enforcement of the immigration laws, which require you to really crack down on employers who consistently and consciously hire illegal aliens. He failed to do that. He failed to secure the border against an invasion, and that's what I called it in the subtitle of an earlier book, an invasion from the third world across the southern border of the United States. We have learned last week that 6 million illegal aliens, or just about 6 million, entered the United States in the last 7 years. That is an enormous number of people. The president says one in every 12 has a criminal record, and that he has failed to secure the borders means he has failed to enforce the Constitution, which obligates him to defend the states against invasion. Governor Huckabee said he did give scholarships, to competitive scholarships, to illegal aliens. Now, that means that the children of American citizens whose parents, fathers might have fought in Vietnam, somebody lost a scholarship for that kid to get one who is here illegally. That is unfair. The gentleman is right that laws are on the books. Many of us don't like a lot of laws on those books, but you cannot ignore the laws. I mean, Richard Nixon was allegedly impeached for not seeing to it that the laws of the nation were faithfully executed. This is exactly what this administration and Congress are doing. And the alienation of the American people from their government on this issue is extraordinary, Joy. I have rarely seen any issue on which the people are so far away from the people who run the government of the United States. In many ways, we are ceasing to be a democratic republic, in that the will of the people, even as expressed in law, is ignored.
We're talking with Pat Buchanan. He is the author of a brand new book, Day of Reckoning, How Hubris, Ideology, and Greed Are Tearing America Apart. Talking about how the illegal immigration problem, how trade issues, other economic issues, and foreign policy mistakes have America in a state of crisis right now. And we're welcoming your thoughts and questions for Pat Buchanan. 1-800-642-1234 in Madison, 263-1890. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Joy Cardine, hoping you'll stay tuned. Kathleen Dunn is with you after 9 o'clock. And after 9, Kathleen and her guest will talk about how the Iowa caucus process works. That's coming up after 9 o'clock. We're talking with Pat Buchanan. He is a former presidential advisor, a former presidential candidate, a best-selling author, a political commentator that you see on television quite a bit. And we're talking with him right now about current issues of the day and also the issues that he brings up in his new book, Day of Reckoning. 1-800-642-1234 in Madison, 263-1890. One of the current issues of the day, President Bush holding a news conference yesterday and reacting to the National Intelligence Estimate that said that Iran stopped its nuclear weapons program in 2003.
I think it is very important for the international community to recognize the fact that if Iran were to develop the knowledge that they could transfer to a clandestine program, it would create a danger for the world. And so I view this report as a warning signal that they had the program, they halted the program. And the reason why it's a warning signal is that they could restart it.
So, Pat Buchanan, what do you make of all this? The president says Iran is, was, and still is a threat.
Well, what I make of it, in the last month or 2 months since October, the president's been talking about the potential for World War III, for a nuclear holocaust, the origins of which would be an Iranian nuclear weapon smuggled into the United States or dropped on the United States by Iran or terrorists whom Iran supported. There has been a stampede toward war with Iran led by the president and the vice president of the United States. The American people have been persuaded, almost half of them, that this is a mortal peril and that we may have to go to war and attack and destroy the nuclear sites before Iran gets an atomic weapon and gives it to terrorists. And we now know that the 2005 intelligence estimate that said Iran was virtually hell-bent on securing a weapon, nuclear weapon, was wrong, according to the intelligence community. We have learned in 2007 that Iran's secret nuclear program for weaponry was halted in 2003. This raises a number of questions. Did the President of the United States know Iran's nuclear program, weapons program, had been halted in 2003 when he was raising the alarms of World War III in 2007?
Mm-hmm.
When did the intelligence community discover that its 2005 analysis was flat wrong, and it was 2 years behind the time that Iran had stopped its nuclear project, weapons project? And when did they inform the President and Vice President and Ms. Rice and Mr. Hadley that they had a gathering consensus that Iran had stopped its program? The President said he learned it last week.
Right.
I find that preposterous. I find that preposterous because he says he learned in August. Mike McConnell, the head of the CIA, came in and said, we've got new information on Iraq. But he didn't tell the President what it was. I mean, if someone walks into the Oval Office and said, Mr. President, we got some fairly dramatic new intelligence on Iraq, the first question is, what is it?
Right.
Have they got the bomb? What is it? And you go right at that, especially if, as the President's been telling us, we are in imminent danger of World War III. So what I recommended on another program earlier this morning on MSNBC is, Mr. Biden is not going to win the nomination. Mr. Biden ought to come back to Washington, D.C., call the Foreign Relations Committee into session, call up the Secretary of State, the Secretary of Defense, the head of the CIA, and Mr. Negroponte, who headed the intelligence unit, and ask them directly, when were you first informed that the Iranian program may have been discontinued or had been discontinued, and did you tell the President? And I think we ought to find this out, because with due respect, and maybe I shouldn't be angry about this, but it seems to me we were stampeded into an unnecessary war with Iraq. We smashed and destroyed and invaded and occupied a country which never attacked us in order to strip it of weapons it did not have based on either faulty or faked intelligence. And now we are headed, we're headed toward a second war with Iran based on faulty or faked intelligence.
Do you think this halts that possible second war with Iran?
I think this has blown a hole in the President's policy of war with Iran. I think it has blown a hole in the congressional drive to war with Iran in that Kyle resolution, Kyle Lieberman, which it almost authorized the President to attack Iran. We have had a drumbeat for war from the neoconservatives, from the White House, that has been resisted, Joy, as I understand it, by the Secretary of Defense, Secretary of State, certainly by Admiral Fox Fallon in the Gulf, by the Joint Chiefs of Staff, many of whom don't want another war. And I think what may have happened here is that the intelligence community, realizing it had been used and abused in the run-up to the Gulf War, to the Iraq War, said, we're not going to let this happen again. We're not going to let the neoconservatives and the White House drag us into another war when we're sitting on intelligence which suggests there may be no need for that war, and that they either leaked this or began to leak it or forced it into the public sector. And if they did, God bless them.
Dan in Partyville, hi, you're on the air.
It's a pleasure to speak with you, Mr. Buchanan. You've pretty much stated that Bush and Cheney lied to the American people to get us into Iraq. So my question is, should Bush and Cheney be held accountable for lying to the American people, leading us into this disastrous, unjustified war? 3,000 Americans killed, 10,000 or more wounded. It sounds like high crimes and misdemeanors to me.
Yeah.
What should the consequences be? I'll hang up and listen.
Well, the Congress of the United States has the power to declare war. Mr. Bush may call himself the decider, but under the Constitution, he is not the decider on whether we go to war. The Congress is. The President fights the war. The Congress decides. The Congress of the United States has already failed in its duty when the Senate, a Democratic Senate, gave George Bush a blank check to go to war in October 2002. A blank check signed over to him by Hillary Clinton, Tom Daschle, Mr. Biden, Mr. Edwards, Mr. Kerry, Mr. Reed. They all signed on to the blank check for war, and the president cashed it and went to war. So it'd be a little bit hard for the Congress to impeach the president of the United States for going to war when they authorized him to go to war. Now, they should have looked at the intelligence themselves, called people up, and said, explain to me what is the danger in Iraq after we smashed them in 91. We've had U.N. inspectors in there, and we bombed them. How could they have built up weapons that they didn't even use when they had them? Now, in the run-up to the Iran war, which we have not had, they had an obligation this time to call up and find out exactly what is the peril to the United States of America. Is it imminent, and does it justify preemptive war? Instead of doing that, the Democrats, Republicans especially, but Democrats like Ms. Clinton also, been saying all options are on the table, the military options on the table, and the Republicans have been talking about using tactical atomic weapons. And we now find out, based on nothing, the President of the United States has been up there talking, I mean, with due respect, close to demagoguing this issue to stampede the country into hysteria so we all endorse another war. But Congress has enabled the president in the first war, and Congress has failed to really hold hearings and tell us, what do the Iranians have? What is the best intelligence? Get al-Baradei down here. Get everybody down here and find out how imminent and grave the danger is. Joy, this is the whole idea of preemptive war is based on if you have faulty intelligence, preemptive war is aggressive war. If you're basing it on fake or false intelligence, it's a war of aggression. You know, Bismarck said preemptive war is like committing suicide out of fear of death. And so I think Mr. Biden ought to come back off the trail. He's not going to win this nomination, and do his country a national service by holding hearings and finding out what the president knew and what the vice president knew and when they knew it. They can't be called. They're constitutional officers of another branch. But Ms. Rice, Gates, Negroponte, McConnell, all of them should be up there. And you can't call Hadley, or you can call him, but we ought to know the answer to these questions.
Yeah. Is there a presidential candidate, especially on the Republican side, that you think has proper foreign policy credentials and your view on these issues?
Well, a lot of them have credentials, but... you know, I think Senator McCain is as militant a hawk as you will find. And Mr. Giuliani has been, you know, talking about they're driving for nuclear weapons. They are not. Where did he base that on? The president said so. He hadn't seen any intelligence. And so we now know they stopped that program. But there's another question here. If the intelligence agencies 2 years ago said Iran is going for a nuclear weapon when they'd canceled it 2 years before, how good are the American intelligence agencies? Are they failing too? And if Iran were to renew its program, when would they find out? 4 years from now? I mean, you have to base foreign policy on hard facts or the best facts you can find. If what you're coming up with is dead wrong, I mean, the idea of going to war and getting 4,000 men killed, 30,000 wounded, hundreds of thousands of Iraqis dead, wounded, millions homeless... I mean, this is incredible.
It was a presidential candidate on the Democratic side yesterday during a debate in Iowa, Mike Gravel, who said, Iran's not a problem, never has been, never will be. What you're seeing right now is something very unique, very courageous, referring to the report. What the intelligence community has done is dropkick the president of the United States.
I agree with Mike Gravel. If they finally got up and said, look, we know information that suggests that this warmongering or this stampeding is leading us to a war for which there is no cause, and we have to leak this information, and we have to go public to stop it this time, then God bless them.
Yeah. Back to the phones. Bill in Milwaukee is with us. Hi, Bill. You're on the air.
Hi. Thanks for having me. Pat, it's a true honor. I agree with you strongly on your foreign policy issues. This kind of idea that we have to be on a constant war standing because there's people out there that want to hurt us, it seems preposterous to me. Secondly, I live in the near south side of Milwaukee. It's a strongly Hispanic community. And I just see American values portrayed very strongly within this community. Now, I know it's illegal immigration that you have a problem with, and I'd like to address that. A friend of mine works for a staffing service here in the same community, and he says easily 60-70% of the people that work for him are illegal immigrants, and it's stunning to me. So what I want to ask you is, what can we do then to businesses? I know that there's laws already on the books, but people say it's impossible to purge this country of illegal immigration, but it seems that we start with businesses. And I just wonder if you'll address that issue, and I'll take my response off the air. Thank you.
Sure. There's no question that many of the folks coming in here, legally or illegally from Spanish countries, many of them bring very solid values. Many of them are Catholic. Some are evangelical Christians. Many of them are devout. Of course, their kids get caught up in our popular culture, which is pretty corrosive, and they're not immune to its effects any more than anyone else is, and their kids are really having difficulties in terms of gang membership and things like that. But undeniably, and I know my brother works in a business where other businesses, he says one thing about these guys is they're friendly and they work harder than anybody. And I got a call from a fellow friend of mine who's a conservative Zion. He said, you know, Pat, I show up at 6 in the morning, I like to work, and it's me and everybody else is speaking Spanish, and they all like to work as much as I do. Now, at the same time, you cannot have an invasion of your country across your border and have that border wide open when the whole world is now coming. You've tripled the number of those coming from other than Mexico since 9/11. So I think what you need to do with businesses, first you need a secure border fence, and not a virtual fence, none of that nonsense, a fence. Fences work. That's why people put them around their houses, they put them around their farms, they put them around everything. They work. They're not foolproof. They never have been. The fence around the White House isn't foolproof, but we don't put a virtual fence around the White House. So you build the fence, then you start, and then you go along with what Arizona has done, that illegal aliens are not eligible for any social welfare benefits whatsoever, except emergency, of course. Third is, you interpret the 14th Amendment correctly under... And Congress can do this by saying, if your child born to an illegal alien in the United States, you are not automatically a citizen. You are not automatically entitled to the benefits. Fourth, you go after the businesses. Take the big ones and hire great numbers of people. Get to hit them with very heavy fines. And if it's repeated, you know, put some of the corporate guys down on that border mixing cement for the fence. And you do that a few times, and then people will stop hiring, and you back up small communities like Farmers Branch, Hazleton. Then you make immigration, the English the official language of the United States. You call a temporary halt, or time out, not a halt, to immigration such as we had from 1923 to 1945, or 65. You do these steps. I've got 10 of them in my book, Day of Reckoning. 10 simple steps. They're not easy, but they are simple. You do those, and in 10 years, the problem will be under control. Now, you talk about those nice folks out there. Is there going to be tragedy involved and sadness? Kids who've gone to grammar school here and are crying and are headed for the border with their illegal alien parents? Yep. And that happens when you have people who will not enforce the law and things happen as a consequence. But if you grant an amnesty, which is the other side, and they say everybody, that will spare us all this tragedy and the rest, if you have an amnesty, that's the end of the United States, in my view, because the whole world will come. Everyone will say, that's the second amnesty. We are complete fools. These people don't have the ability or nerve to expel anybody. Get in there, keep your head down, and we'll all be in there for good.
Yeah, and that, why would that end the U.S. as we know it?
Well, because I think the melting pot is cracked. And when our parents and great-grandparents came, they went into public schools where they were taught American history and heroes and holidays and literature and all the rest. That melting pot is cracked, broken, rejected by our multicultural elites who think that everybody should retain their own culture and language and tradition, and it is cultural genocide to try to convert them, if you will, in that melting pot into Americans. And if we don't become Americans, we'll lose America.
Our guest is Pat Buchanan. We are talking with him about the issues he raises in his new book, Day of Reckoning, How Hubris, Ideology, and Greed Are Tearing America Apart. And we welcome your question for him at 1-800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234, in Madison, 263-1890. Or send an email, talk@wpr.org. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Joy Cardine. Hoping you'll stay tuned. Kathleen Dunn is with you after 9 o'clock talking about the Iowa caucus process at first, and then talking with the author of For Love of Politics, Bill and Hillary Clinton, the White House Years After 10 o'clock. We're talking with best-selling author, political commentator, former presidential advisor, and presidential candidate, Patrick J. Buchanan. Pat Buchanan, author of Day of Reckoning, How Hubris, Ideology, and Greed Are Tearing America Apart. And our next caller is Tim in Appleton. Hi, Tim. You're on the air.
Good morning. Wonderful program. Mr. Buchanan, I agree with almost everything you say. One question, I'd like a nice straight answer, as you usually give. Why is Sandy Berger not in prison, especially since the Republicans were in power when he did his crime? Thank you.
Probably he's got political pull with both parties. There's a tendency in Washington to, when one or the other's big boys gets in trouble, to take good care of them and for the other side not to complain too much because they know one of their own's going to be in the same shape. He got off and Scooter Libby walked without even seeing the inside of a minimum security facility. And so, look, there is one law for those in Washington and another law for the rest of the country. That's the truth.
Sean in Janesville is next. Hi, Sean.
Yeah, how you doing? Mm-hmm. Pleasure talking to Mr. Buchanan. I want to ask you, I've been confused. I've kind of grown up over the last 10 years, right, become an adult. And I thought I was a liberal, and until I kind of studied those terms and read a little about Barry Goldwater, and actually agreed with a lot of his views, and I think those terms have been flipped. And then I would ask you about Ron Paul, and if you would endorse him, and why or why not.
Well, I haven't endorsed for the reason that I think it would be unfair to other folks. For example, my sister is running. My sister is running Tancredo's campaign, and I would have a bad time at Christmas if I endorsed Ron Paul. That's one reason. But the second is I like Tom Tancredo. I think he's been very courageous in running leading the battle on the immigration thing. I think Duncan Hunter's ideas on trade are closer to mine than any other Republican. Clearly, I think I don't want to see an interventionist foreign policy, and Ron Paul is excellent on that. I've just felt that you ought not to step in at this point and endorse and before these fellows have had a chance to make their own case. Now, Ron Paul has done outstandingly well. I don't think he'll do extremely well in Iowa, but I think he could really surprise folks in New Hampshire, which is tailor-made for him. But I just don't think I ought to endorse any single candidate right now. I think I've got a lot of supporters out there. And you know, let me tell you a story. I went up to New Hampshire. Gary Hart and I, who were both previous winners of the New Hampshire primary, we were fated at a big dinner to save the New Hampshire primary, which I love. And so we were there, and I had a party, a cocktail party the night before, and I brought all of my old campaign folks who were with me. And I counted up with talking with a few people. They were with five different candidates. In other words, the Buchanan brigades were split up, and they've got loyalty to different people for different reasons. And I understand why they did, and I just feel I ought not right now to step in and endorse. I know a lot of people have called and asked, why not endorse Ron Paul? And they're good Ron Paul folks, I'm sure.
Yeah. David in Appleton might be a Ron Paul fan, too. David, go ahead.
Yes, you guessed correctly. Another Ron Paul fan here.
Right.
But, Pat, I wanted to, well, first I was just about cheering myself here in the car, listening to you talk about the war crimes of the Bush administration, and really appreciate your frankness and forthrightness on that issue. My question, though, is on the trade issue. I mean, you consider yourself, I shouldn't put words in your mouth, but sort of a protectionist of sorts, or at least a fair trader. And Ron Paul calls himself a free trader. However, you know, he is against every institution set up by the international One World crowd to facilitate what they call free trade. So is the net effect of a Ron Paul foreign policy very similar to yours anyway?
Well, I think Ron Paul and I agree on, and frankly, there are a lot of phrases I've seen in my friend Ron Paul's where he says, use the phrase America first. Mm-hmm. That was my theme back in 1992 and 96, and his line, they are over here about the terrorists because we are over there, is right out of my columns and books. And I think Ron Paul and I think very clearly, or excuse me, maybe not clearly, we think similarly on the folly of the war in Iraq and the unwisdom of having the United States extended in war guarantees all over the world dating to Truman and Acheson during the Cold War, which I supported up until the end of the Cold War when the Soviet Empire collapsed and the Soviet Union fell apart. And so on foreign policy, on bringing American troops home from Cold War bases, from getting rid of some of these alliances, which are transmission belts of war, and giving the present generation, look, if we're going to go to war, you know, Jefferson said the world belongs to the living, not the dead. And this generation ought to vote and decide when and whether we ought to go to war. That decision shouldn't be made for us by John Foster Dulles or Dean Acheson, who laid down some tripwire 60 years ago. On that, on trade, Ron Paul opposed NAFTA, I believe, and GATT and the World Trade Organization and all these transnational institutions. But I would differ with him, I think, and that I've become very much a Hamiltonian on trade, a belief that tariffs should be used and we should raise tariffs on foreign manufacturers and take the funds and cut the income taxes on Americans or cut the taxes on manufacturers in the United States. Because my central concern is the working and middle class, that they are losing their jobs, especially in manufacturing, but soon the white-collar jobs by outsourcing, mass immigration, and moving and basically moving factories and things to China and to Mexico. So we have similar views. They're probably not identical, but they're certainly identical in the battle against NAFTA and in the fight not to go to war against Iraq.
Pat Buchanan, I want you to react to what might have been one of the more amusing moments from yesterday's debate. It was the Democratic presidential candidate debate sponsored by National Public Radio, where here we hear John Edwards being questioned about trade with China.
Ms. Kerr, as you mentioned these Chinese toys, Senator Edwards, you have two small children.
Yes.
Will you be buying toys that are made in China to place under the Christmas tree this year?
No, ma'am. I will not.
Better give Chris Dodd equal time on that.
It's difficult to do that because, you know, 70% of the goods and most of the toys that you find at the local Walmart are made in China.
My kids will not have toys coming from China.
Barack and I would like to comment on this. my toys are coming from Iowa. I'm buying Iowa toys. They're going to eat Iowa food.
That's pretty good. That was Chris Dodd.
The only one not enjoying it is Mitt Romney's landscaper.
Oh, yeah, there we go. Well, talk some about these issues we've had with China products lately.
Well, they are. Some of them, I think some of them are faulty, and they ought to be any product coming into the United States. This is one thing, a lot of us may think the society's overregulated, but there's no doubt that the regulation of things in the United States for health and safety, if we pass these laws, they ought to be enforced, and they ought to be enforced on all products coming in, ought to face the same laws, rules, and regulations. With regard to China, the problem with China, look, the Chinese are very hard-working people, and the Chinese government has devalued its currency to back in 1994, cut the value of its currency, let it down to about half of what it was, and thereby made, of course, their manufacturing far more competitive in terms of the wages of their workers, and priced, basically, American goods were suddenly priced out of their market. So they ran up a $233 billion trade surplus with us last year. They're drawing factories, jobs, technology, and now R&D plants or R&D facilities are being moved over near their factories. These are all American companies and European countries and transnational companies, Japanese. And we are industrializing China as we are deindustrializing ourselves. Now, many of the free traders say, well, who cares where a product is produced as long as I can get it at the cheapest possible price. And that's, of course, the David Ricardo theory of the libertarian theory of free trade. And I don't hold to it. I'm very much a Hamiltonian. I believe that the trade has very much to do with national power, national prominence, national security. And I believe that imported goods should carry the burden of taxation as they did in the 19th century. They can't do it entirely anymore. But I think that should carry the burden of taxation, and your taxes on your own manufacturers and your own workers should be reduced to the minimum. And I believe that the tariffs at the same time encourage manufacturing and encourage companies to invest in the United States and build their plants here to get inside the tariff wall. So this is I wrote a book back in 1998 called The Great Betrayal, how sovereignty and national security are being sacrificed on the altar of the global economy. And that's the kind of policy I would like to see followed. And it's called, you know, they dismiss it as protectionism, as they dismiss an American first foreign policy as isolationism. Neither is really true. I mean, I believe we can't isolate ourselves in the world. We're a huge country. And as for protecting American industry, there are vital industries I would certainly protect, but I do believe we should have a bias, we Americans, toward our own workers, toward our own producers, who, after all, is the American economy for, if not for our own people first.
Our guest is Pat Buchanan. The book is Day of Reckoning. And, Pat Buchanan, how far off is this Day of Reckoning?
I think it's. I think the perfect storm is almost dead ahead. I think, you take the Social Security Medicare crisis, maybe you can put it off solving it for a couple of years, and the solutions will be infinitely more painful then. I think with regard to Iraq and Afghanistan, that's coming fairly soon. I think if you do not get control of the borders, as I said, I don't think you're really going to have a real country anymore, which is sort of a unique, different, identifiable people. The dollar continues to sink. I think you could have a situation where the Chinese or the others, some of the oil importing countries, say, "Look, we want to price our oil in a different currency." All of these things are coming up the road at us, and the overextension of the American empire. You could see something happen in Kosovo, Bosnia, places like that, where the United States simply doesn't have the troops to fulfill their commitments. And so I think they're all coming at us, and I don't see the awareness of it. Certainly, not the awareness I feel, or the acuteness of concern that I feel. And so you sort of write these things, and you know, I wrote in 1991, or campaigned. I said, "Look, this—if you don't get control of your borders, you're going to have a hellish problem." Well, 18 years later, we got a hellish problem.
Let's take another caller, Ed in Wausau. Hi, Ed. You're on the air.
Hi. Old-time watcher of McLaughlin Report, Pat. Paul Wolfowitz just got a new job at the State Department. I was just wondering what your thoughts were on that.
Well, we want to congratulate Paul. Look, my old friend from... I worked with all these neoconservatives when I was in the Reagan White House, and many of them, some of them when I was in the Nixon White House. And to bring them back in. And, Joy, this is one of my concerns. I look at Rudy Giuliani's foreign policy team led by Norman Podhoretz, who speaks and says, as a Jew and an American, I go down on my knees every night and pray that we bomb Iran. Mm. And then he says, I had a good conversation with Rudy, and he basically agrees with me. And, I mean, he's got a lot of neoconservatives in his entourage that look like they were cut by the Vulcans for extremism. So I'm concerned about this is what concerns me about the Republicans. I mean, your natural tendency when I'm not on the ballot, is to vote Republican. Of course, I'm a conservative. But I must say, some of these folks make you nervous.
Steve in Houston, Texas. Hi, you're on the air.
Yes, good morning. Thank you so much. Mr. Buchanan, I agree so much with your viewpoint on the war against Islam. And that is really how the Islamic world views it. I mean, collectively, they view a war against the Islamic Brotherhood and another nation as a war against them. And I think a president has just declared war on half the world. And I would like to ask your viewpoint on religious liberty, because America, we just passed the 400th year of, I think, the founding of Jamestown, and this country has received such enormous blessing from God. Mm-hmm. We have such prosperity that the world has never seen. And I attribute that, as I'm sure you'll agree, because we have opened our borders to people, especially from communist nations. Thanks to President Reagan, we saw many nations liberated from communism in Nicaragua, Grenada, you know, Eastern Europe, the collapse of Soviet communism, and we were blessed by God. But I fear now that we're turning away from that. There are millions of Muslims in this country. And here in Houston, where I live, we do a lot of interfaith work in my family. Yeah. We work with the Universal Peace Federation, founded by Reverend Dr. Sung Yung Moon. And there are so many people in this country that we could work with and ally with and to show the world that still America is a bastion of hope and freedom. but we are making enemies of many peoples in the world because of
Steve,
because
your
of this
question
war.
Your question for Pat Buchanan.
Well, yeah, okay, my question is how can we turn our policies back to where we can receive the protection of God so we don't have this day of judgment, which is coming.
All right. Do you have an answer for that?
Well, I take the gentleman's point. We are making enemies. When you consider after the Cold War decade of the 1980s began when Ronald Reagan called the Soviet Union an evil empire, and he was right to do so. It was a malevolent empire, hell-bent on world conquest, which rejected all the values we believe in and was wedded to worshipped power and world power ultimately. But at the end of 1988, Ronald Reagan was walking through Red Square with Mikhail Gorbachev, and the Russian people were patting him on the back. And we had the friendship of the Russian people. And in 1991, we had their support and the support of China and the support of all the countries in the world except for the PLO, I think, for the liberation of Kuwait. And the world has changed dramatically. And we are not seen as the moral leader of the world, and we are seen in many cases as an imperial power, and we are seen as an arrogant country that talks about being the indispensable nation. And we are widely detested throughout the Arab and Islamic world because we are perceived as having come in there and smashed this country, which despite its regime, had done nothing to us. And then we occupied it. We're going to convert it into a democratic country at the cost of hundreds of thousands of its people and, you know, millions of refugees. And so I don't think that was right, and I don't think it was just war, and I don't think it was a wise war. And so I think we got to stop doing those things, and we got to walk humbly with our God.
Yeah. Well, we're out of time. Thank you, Pat Buchanan, very much for being with us.
Well, thank you, Joy.
Pat Buchanan, author of Day of Reckoning, How Hubris, Ideology, and Greed Are Tearing America Apart. Pat Buchanan, also a former presidential advisor, former presidential candidate, syndicated columnist, founding member of the McLaughlin Group, the Capital Gang, and Crossfire. We thank Carmen Jackson for producing the hour, and we thank Karen Prager and Leo Duran for on-air production and direction. And I thank you for listening and for calling in. I hope you stay tuned. I hope you will join us tomorrow during this time, actually between 8:30 and 9. We have another very well-known television commentator and author, Lou Dobbs, will be with us tomorrow between 8:30 and 9, talking about his new book, Independence Day. I'm Joy Cardine. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.